The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Larissa Biggers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading poems from the Poets Laureate Anthology, published in 2010, and sharing relevant information from various online sources. Today's focus is on iconic American poets who are all poet laureates at the state or national level. We'll start with one of my favorite poems, Mending Wall, published in 1914 by Robert Frost. Born in 1874, Frost was well known for his realistic depictions of rural life and his command of everyday speech. He often wrote about New England's settings in the early 20th century, using them to examine complex themes. Frost died in 1963. Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair, where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean. No one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There, where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't where there are cows? But here, there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors. The second Robert Frost poem I'll read is called Birches. Birches. When I see birches bend to left and right, across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think, some boy's been swinging them, but swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust. Such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and there they seem not to break, though once they are bowed so low for so long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterward, trailing their leaves on the ground, like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out or in to fetch the cows. Some boy, too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them. and not one but hung lip. Not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon, and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same points you use to fill a cup up to the brim, and even over the brim. Then he flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I, once myself a swinger of birches. And so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood, where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from the earth a while, and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away, not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. Our next poet is William Carlos Williams. He was born in 1883 and he died in 1963. William Carlos Williams was known for his modernist style and his use of colloquial American English. He was also a doctor, and his medical practice deeply influenced his poetry. Williams is celebrated for his innovative approach to form and his focus on the everyday experiences of ordinary people. The first Williams poem I'll read is called The Widow's Lament in Springtime. Sorrow is my own yard, where the new grass flames as it has flamed often before, but not with the cold fire that closes around me this year. 35 years I lived with my husband. The plum tree is white today with masses of flowers. Masses of flowers load the cherry branches and color some bushes yellow and some red. But the grief in my heart is stronger than they, for though they were my joy formerly, today I notice them and turn away, forgetting. Today, my son told me that in the meadows, at the edge of the heavy woods in the distance, he saw trees of white flowers. I feel that I would like to go there and fall into those flowers and sink into the marsh near them. The second Williams poem I'll read is called This Is Just to Say. This is just to say I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me. They were delicious, so sweet and so cold. And the third and final William Carlos Williams poem I'll read today is called The Last Words of My English Grandmother. There were some dirty plates and a glass of milk beside her on a small table, near the rank, disheveled bed. Wrinkled and nearly blind, she lay and snored, rousing with anger in her tones to cry for food. "Give me something to eat. They're starving me." "I'm all right. I won't go to the hospital." "No, no, no. Give me something to eat." "Let me take you to the hospital," I said, "and after you are well, you can do as you please." She smiled. "Yes, you do what you please first, and then I can do what I please." "Oh, oh, oh," she cried as the ambulance man lifted her into the stretcher. "Is this what you call making me comfortable?" By now her mind was clear. "Oh, you think you're so smart, you young people," she said. "But I'll tell you, you don't know anything." Then we started. On the way, we passed a long row of elms. She looked at them a while out of the ambulance window and said, "What are all those fuzzy-looking things out there? Trees? Well, I'm tired of them," and rolled her head away. Our next poet is Elizabeth Bishop. Elizabeth Bishop, born in 1911, was known for her precise language, detailed observations, and explorations of personal experiences and travel. Her father died when she was 8 months old, and her mother was institutionalized for mental illness. Her childhood was spent with grandparents in Nova Scotia and later with relatives. She died in 1976. The first Bishop poem I'll read is called The Fish. I caught a tremendous fish and held him beside the boat, half out of water, with my hook fast in the corner of his mouth. He didn't fight. He hadn't fought at all. He hung a grunting weight, battered and vulnerable and homely. Here and there, his brown skin hung in strips like ancient wallpaper, and its pattern of darker brown was like wallpaper, shapes like full-blown roses stained and lost through age. He was speckled with barnacles, fine rosettes of lime, and infested with tiny white sea lice, and underneath, two or three rags of green weed hung down. While his gills were breathing in the terrible oxygen, the frightening gills fresh and crisp with blood that can cut so badly, I thought of the coarse white flesh packed in like feathers, the big bones and the little bones, the dramatic reds and blacks of his shiny entrails, and the pink swim bladder, like a big peony. I looked into his eyes, which were far larger than mine, but shallower and yellowed, the irises backed and packed with tarnished tinfoil, seen through the lenses of old scratched Insiglass. They shifted a little, but not to return my stare. It was more like the tipping of an object toward the light. I admired his sullen face, the mechanism of his jaw, and then I saw that from his lower lip, if you could call it a lip, grim, wet, and weapon-like, hung five old pieces of fish line, or four in a wire leader, with the swivel still attached, with all their five big hooks grown firmly in his mouth. A green line, frayed at the end where he broke it, two heavier lines, and a fine black thread, still crimped from the strain and snap when it broke and he got away. Like metals with their ribbons, frayed and wavering, a five-haired beard of wisdom trailing from his aching jaw. I stared and stared, and victory filled up the little rented boat. From the pool of bilge where oil had spread a rainbow around the rusted engine to the baler, rusted orange, and the sun-cracked thwarts, the oarlocks on their strings, the gunnels, until everything was rainbow, 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 and I let the fish go. The second poem I'll read by Elizabeth Bishop is called In the Waiting Room. In Worcester, Massachusetts, I went with Aunt Consuelo to keep her dentist appointment and sat and waited for her in the dentist waiting room. It was winter. It got dark early. The waiting room was full of grown people, arctics and overcoats, lamps, and magazines. My aunt was inside what seemed like a long time, and while I waited and read the National Geographic, I could read, and carefully studied the photographs, the inside of a volcano, black and full of ashes, and then it was spilling over in rivulets of fire. Osa and Martin Johnson, dressed in riding breeches, lace boots, and pith helmets. A dead man slung on a pole. Long pig, the caption said. Babies with pointed heads wound round and round with string. Black naked women with necks wound round and round with wire like the necks of light bulbs. Their breasts were horrifying. I read it straight through. I was too shy to stop. And then I looked at the cover, the yellow margin, the date. Suddenly, from inside, came an "oh" of pain. Aunt Consuela's voice, not very loud or long. I wasn't at all surprised. Even then, I knew she was a foolish, timid woman. I might have been embarrassed, but wasn't. What took me completely by surprise was that it was me, my voice in my mouth. Without thinking at all, I was my foolish aunt. We were falling, our eyes glued to the cover of the National Geographic, February 1918. I said to myself, 3 days and you'll be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round, turning world into cold, blue-black space. But I felt, you are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Why should you be one too? I scarcely dared to look to see what it is I was. I gave a sidelong glance, I couldn't look any higher, at shadowy gray knees, trousers, and skirts and boots, and different pairs of hands lying under the lamps. I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened, that nothing stranger could ever happen. Why should I be my aunt or me or anyone? What similarities, boots, hands, the family voice I felt in my throat, or even the National Geographic and those awful hanging breasts, held us all together or made us all just one? How I didn't know any word for it, how unlikely. How had I come to be here like them and overhear a cry of pain that could have gotten loud and worse but hadn't? The waiting room was bright and too hot. It was sliding beneath a big black wave, another and another. Then I was back in it. The war was on. Outside in Worcester, Massachusetts, were night and slush and cold. And it was still the 5th of February, 1918. Our next poet is Maxine Cumin. Maxine Cumin, who was born in 1925 and died in 2014, was a Pulitzer Prize-winning American poet, novelist, essayist, and children's author. Her poetry explores themes of family, nature, and the cycles of life, often written in traditional forms. Her first poem is Seven Caveats in May. When the dog whines at 5 a.m., do not make your first mistake and let him out. When he starts to bark in a furious tom-tom rhythm, and you can just discern a shadowy fainting taking place under the distant hemlocks, do not seize the small sledge from the work table and fly out there in your nightgown and unlaced high tops, preparing to whack this, the ninth of its kind, in the last 10 weeks over the head before it can quill your canine. But it's not a porcupine. It's a big, black, angry bear. Now your dog has put him up a tree and plans to keep him there, a perfect piece of work by any hound. Do not run back and grab the manure fork, thinking you can keep the prongs between you and the elevated bear long enough to dart in and corral your critter. Isn't it true bears come down slower than they go up? Half an hour later, do not give up. Go in the house and call the cops. The dispatcher regrets having to report there's no patrol car at this time. The state police are covering. No doubt the nearest trooper wearing his smoky bear Stetson is 40 miles up the highway. When your closest neighbor, big burly Smitty, works his way into his jeans and roars up your dirt road in his four-wheel diesel truck, strides over to the slash pile and hauls your hound back, by now you've thrown something on over your not-quite-diaphanous nightgown. Do not forget to thank him with a six-pack. Do not fail to take your feeders in on April 1, despite the arriving bird's insistent clamor, and do not put them out again until the 1st of December. Cumin's next poem is called Life's Work. Mother, my good girl, I remember this old story. You, fresh out of the conservatory at 18, a box specialist in a starched shirtwaist, begging permission to go on tour with the nimble violinist you were never to accompany. And he, flinging his music down, the rosin from his bow flaking line by line like grace notes on the treble clef. And my grandfather. That estimable man I never met, scrubbing your mouth with a handkerchief, saying, "No daughter of mine," tearing loose the gold locket you wore with no one's picture in it, and the whole German house on 15th Street at a righteous white heat. At 18, I chose to be a swimmer. My long hair dripped through the dinner onto the china plate. My fingers crinkled like sunsweet yellow raisins from the afternoon workout. My mouth chewed, but I was doing laps. I entered the water like a knife. I was all muscle and seven doors, a frog on the running board, king of the eels and the eel's wife. I swallowed and prayed to be allowed to join the aquacade, and my perfect daddy, who carried you off to elope after the fingerboard snapped and the violinist lost his case. My daddy, wearing gravy on his face, swore on the carrots and the boiled beef that I would come to nothing, that I would come to grief. Well, the firm old fathers are dead, and I didn't come to grief. I came to words instead, to tell the little tale that's left. The midnights of my childhood still go on. The stairs speak again under your foot. The heavy parlor door folds shut, and Claire de Lune puckers from the obedient keys, plain as a schoolroom clock ticking. And what I hear more clearly than Debussy's love song is the dry after sound of your long nails clicking. Our next poet is Billy Collins. Born in 1941 in New York City, Billy Collins is a poet whose accessible verse, characterized by plain language, gentle humor, and appreciation for the mundane, makes him one of the most popular poets in the United States. Collins's first poem that I'll read today is called The Art of Drowning. I wonder how it all got started, this business about seeing your life flash before your eyes while you drown, as if panic or the act of submergence should startle time to such compression, crushing decades in the vice of your desperate final seconds. After falling off a steamship or being swept away in a rush of floodwaters, wouldn't you hope for a more leisurely review? An invisible hand turning pages of an album of photographs. You, up on a pony or blowing out candles in a conic hat. How about a short animated film, a slide presentation? Your life expressed in an essay or in one model photograph. Wouldn't any form be better than this sudden flash? Your whole existence going off in your face in an eyebrow-singeing explosion of biography, nothing like the three large volumes you envisioned. Survivors would have us believe in a brilliance here, some bolt of truth forking across the water, an ultimate light before all the lights go out, dawning on you with all its megalithic tonnage. But if something does flash before your eyes as you go under, it will probably be a fish, a quick blur of curved silver darting away, having nothing to do with your life or your death. The tide will take you. The lake will accept it all as you sink toward the weedy disarray at the bottom, leaving behind what you have already forgotten, the surface now overrun with the high travel of clouds. The second Billy Collins poem I'll read is called Litany. You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine. You are the dew on the morning grass and the burning wheel of the sun. You're the white apron of the baker and the marsh bird suddenly in flight. However, you're not the wind in the orchard, the plums on the counter, or the house of cards, and you're certainly not the pine-scented air. There's just no way that you're the pine-scented air. It is possible that you are the fish under the bridge, maybe even the pigeon on the general's head, but you are not even close to being the field of cornflowers at dusk. And a quick look in the mirror will show that you are neither the boots in the corner nor the boat asleep in the boathouse. It might interest you to know, speaking of plentiful imagery of the world, that I am the sound of rain on the roof. I also happen to be the shooting star, the evening paper blowing down an alley, and the basket of chestnuts on the kitchen table. I am also the moon in the trees and the blind woman's teacup. But don't worry, I am not the bread and the knife. You are still the bread and the knife. You will always be the bread and the knife, not to mention the crystal goblet and somehow the wine. Our next poet is Rita Dove. Rita Dove was born in 1952, and she was the first African-American and the youngest person to serve as the Poet Laureate of the United States. A trained cellist, Dove often incorporates music themes into her poems, which are noted for their lyricism. Other themes in her work include family life, history, politics, and race. The first Rita Dove poem that I'm going to read is called This Life. My grandmother told me there'd be good days to counter the dark ones, with blue skies in the heart as far as the soul could see. She said you could measure a life in as many ways as there were to bake a pound cake, but you still needed real butter and eggs for a good one. Pound cake, that is, but I knew what she meant. She was always talking around corners like that. She knew words carried their treasures like a grape cluster around its own juice. She loved words. She thought a book was a monument to the glory of creation, and a library, well, sometimes just trying to describe jubilation will get you a bit tongue, so let's leave it at that. But my grandmother was nobody's fool, and she'd tell anybody smart enough to listen, don't let a little pain stop you. Try as hard as you can every minute you're given, or else just sit down and shut up. Though in her opinion, keeping quiet in noisy times was a sin against everything God and democracy intended for us. I know she would like where I'm standing right now. She'd say, a man who could measure his life in deeds was larger inside than the vessel that carried him. She'd say, he was a cluster of grapes. My grandmother was only 4'10", but when she entered a room, even the books came to attention. Giants come in all sizes. Sometimes a moment is a monument. Sometimes an institution breathes like a library. Like this halcyon day. The second Rita Dove poem is called Lady Freedom Among Us. Don't lower your eyes or stare straight to where you think you ought to be going. Don't mutter, oh no, not another one. Get a job, fly a kite, go bury a bone. With her old-fashioned sandals, with her leaden skirts, with her stained cheeks and whispers and heaped-up trinkets, she has risen among us in blunt reproach. She has fitted her hair under a hand-me-down cap and spruced it up with feathers and stars. Slung over her shoulder, she bears the rainbow layers of charity and murmurs. All of you, even the least of you, don't cross to the other side of the square. Don't think another item to fit on a tourist agenda. Consider her drenched gaze, her shining brow, she who has brought mercy into the streets and will not retire politely to the potter's field. Having assumed the thick skin of this town, its gritted exhaust, its sun-scorch and blear, she rests in her weathered plumage, big-boned, resolute. Don't think you can ever forget her. Don't even try. She's not going to budge. No choice but to grant her her space. Crown her with sky, for she is one of the many, and she is each of us. And that is the last poem of today. Again, the source of today's poems was the Poets Laureate Anthology, published in 2010. A poet laureate serves as an ambassador for poetry, promoting its appreciation and awareness within a community. They often compose poems for special occasions, engage with the public through readings and workshops, and initiate projects to make poetry more accessible. The specific duties can vary based on the appointing body, but the overarching goal is to foster a love of poetry and encourage its use as a form of expression.